If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
If you went on a road trip and you didn't stop for a Big Mac or drop a crispy fry between the car seats or use your McDonald's bag as a placemat, then that wasn't a road trip. It was just a really long drive. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Why is Brittany called Brittany? What exactly is or was a Celt? Did King Arthur have a home in a mystical forest near Wren? Well, Professor Sir Barry Cunliffe is the author of a new book, Bretons and Britons, The Fight for Identity. And in today's podcast, he answers these questions and more about the history of Brittany. Putting the questions to him was our content director, David Musgrove.
Today, I'm joined by Professor Sir Barry Cunliffe, Emeritus Professor of European Archaeology at the University of Oxford. He's excavated widely over many years and is undoubtedly one of our greatest archaeological experts. His latest book is Bretons and Britons, The Fight for Identity, which is published now by Oxford University Press. And as the title suggests, it's a history of Brittany, Bretons and their relationship with Britain. So, Barry, thank you very much for joining us. The first thing we need to do is orientate ourselves. So might you be able to just quickly remind our listeners of the general geography we're talking about here? Where does Brittany sit in relation to Britain? What's its general extent and what sort of landscape features are made up in the Breton Peninsula?
OK, well, let's start with being out in the Atlantic. Assume we're out in the Atlantic, and we're looking towards Europe, we're looking east towards Europe, and we're approaching Europe, and we're approaching Brittany. On our right-hand side, we'll go past Galicia in northwestern Spain. On our left-hand side, we'll go past Ireland. And as we sort of home in into Europe, there in the centre is the peninsula of Brittany. It's a long peninsula, something like 250 kilometres long. So it juts out from the northwest corner of France. In relation to Britain, it runs parallel, the Breton Peninsula runs parallel with the southwest of Britain, that is, with Dorset, Devon, Cornwall. And the two are something like 400 or 500 kilometres apart. So there's just the sea between them, and the sea doesn't divide. The sea actually connects southern Britain, southwestern Britain, to this peninsula of Brittany. Now, it's quite a complicated peninsula. It's old hard rock, and it's really divided into three parts, if you think of it this way. There is the great central spine, which is forest and mountains. They call them mountains in France, but in Brittany, but they're not really mountains. They're sort of hills, Montagne Noire and Mont d'Arrée. And then you've got beyond, outside this core, there is what is called the Argo. That is the land facing the forest. And outside that again is the Armor, which is the land facing the sea. So essentially you've got this outer line of land facing the sea, and then you go inland and there is the Argot, and then inside is this great spine of mountains and forest. So what that really means is that the northern coast of Brittany, which faces Britain, is quite separate from the southern coast of Brittany, which faces across the Bay of Biscay to northern Spain. So Brittany really has got those two main faces. It's also got a third face, its face with France, mainland France. It joins France, obviously, so it's got a land border. But very important is the River Loire, which runs from the Bay of Biscay in the southeast corner of Brittany, deep into West Central Europe, deep into France, and over quite close to the German border, in fact. So Brittany has got these contact zones one north to Britain, one south to Iberia, and one east into West Central Europe.
And you mentioned the Armor, this coastal zone. That's where the word Armorica comes from, I presume.
Yes, indeed. We call it Brittany now, and I'll no doubt fall into the fault of calling it Brittany when I'm talking about prehistory. But it only becomes Brittany as a country when the Britons actually move into Brittany. I'm sure we'll talk about that later, sometime in the 5th and 6th century AD. And before that, it's called Armorica. And the Romans knew it as Armorica. And since Ar and Mor are both Celtic words, presumably the inhabitants of the Breton Peninsula, Armorica, called themselves Armoricans in the pre-Roman period.
Right. Now, your book, which is a brilliant read, takes us from prehistory up to the present day. Obviously, we can't hope to cover everything in the book or all that entire time span. So what I want to do is try and focus on the links between Brittany and Britain, if we can. And we're going to sort of start with prehistory and move forwards, and we'll get into the medieval period. We probably won't get too much further than that, but we'll see how we go with our time. So when can we see the first possible evidence of cross-channel communication between Brittany and Britain?
Well, I think we need to go back to a stage just before when we can first see it. Go back to the Mesolithic period, that's the hunter-gatherer period, when both in Britain and in Armorica, people were hunting their food, they were collecting their food, they were foragers and so on, before farming comes in. We're talking about 7,000, 8,000, 7,000, 6,000 BC, that sort of period. Now, during that time, I think we can be pretty sure that people in both Britain and in Armorica learned how to use the sea. The sea was important to them. They were foraging generally. They were moving with their food. They were moving to collect food from grazing animals and so on, moving into the forest to pick nuts and berries and fungi. They were mobile. They could navigate. They could go from camp to camp and come back again. So they understood navigation. And almost certainly they understood navigation at sea. They would have had hide boats made of skins sewn onto wickerwork, frameworks, that sort of thing. And the sea was as much, for the ones who lived around the coast, the sea was as much a part of their hunting grounds as the land was. And they would follow, as on land they followed herds of animals, on sea they followed the fish, the shoals of fish. And in that way, I imagine these hunter-gatherers from Armorica and Britain came into contact. We've got no hard evidence for this, but there is no reason why they didn't. And when we just move on a little bit, by sort of 5,000 BC, Armorica has got farmers moving into it, so domesticated animals. And then suddenly in Ireland, at about this time, on Mesolithic hunting sites, we find domesticated cattle, or rather bits of domesticated cattle. Now, that is long before farmers got to Ireland. And the only way they could have got these bits of domesticated cattle was by people bringing them from Armorica from overseas. So we must assume that somewhere about 5,000 soon after, hunter-gatherers who were just beginning to be farmers in Armorica were making their traditional sailings up into the Irish Sea and around the British coast. And they were bringing gifts with them, probably gifts of sides of beef or something like that. And that's how these bones got into the Mesolithic sites in Ireland. So that's the first we can actually see of the contact. And what it reminds us, and this is very important for what comes afterwards, is if you think of Britain, Britain has an east side story and a west side story. The east side story of Britain links across the North Sea and the eastern part of the Channel to northern France and Belgium and Holland, that sort of area, the Low Countries. The west side story links Ireland, Western Brittany, Wales, Cornwall with the whole of the Atlantic seaways, which includes Brittany and also includes Spain, and Portugal at this stage. So that West Side story is really the story that links Armorica with Britain. It's that part of that great connectivity which flows through history.
Fantastic. An East Side story and a West Side story. I like it. So we talked about the Mesolithic there. That's the hunter-gatherer period. And in terms of archaeological nomenclature, you're moving into the Neolithic period, which is the farming period. So just for everyone to be reminded of that. Now, I'm just wondering, during this period, was the sea conditions the same as we have now? We know that sea level has risen and fallen during the past. And at one point, there was a land bridge between Britain and Europe, but that wouldn't have been... That wouldn't have been in this area, would it?
No. By the time we're talking about now, the Mesolithic period and the Neolithic period, Britain is very much an island. The only way to get there is by sea. And similarly, Ireland was separated from the rest of the British Isles. But the sea level was continuing to rise during this period, but the rise was getting slower and slower and slower. So in the Mesolithic period, there would have been a little bit more land around the edge, but not very much more. So it's as near as makes no difference the same.
Okay. Now in your book, you talk about the suggestion that there may have been some actual migration from Armorica to Western Britain and Ireland, sort of around about the early 5th millennium. So I think your data were 4,300 to 3,900 BC. You see some sense of a migration. Can you tell us a bit more about that and what that tells us about the sort of cultural contact and similarities between the two areas?
Yeah, well, we've got this idea that even in the period about 5,000 BC, trips were being made from Armorica into the Irish Sea area before the Britons had become farmers. After farming had penetrated the Armorican Peninsula, Brittany, it was coming from two directions. It was coming, farming techniques were coming up from the south, from the west coast of France, and they were coming overland from the Seine Valley region. So you've got farmers moving into Brittany in two ways. And they establish a farming community in Brittany, certainly by 5000 BC. Now, what we see in the archaeological record is very soon after, by 4300 over the next couple of hundred years, we see a contact, the same contact, from Armorica around the southwest of Britain into the Irish Sea area. And this is shown by the distribution in southwest Wales, northwest Wales, the east coast of Ireland and the west coast of Scotland of a certain tomb type. A tomb built of stone blocks, making a kist for the body to be buried in, and set in a simple stone curb. Nothing like it before, but very much like what was being built in southern Brittany at that stage. Also, in this tomb type, we see the beginnings of what is called a passage grave, where instead of being completely contained, this central kist where the body is buried has a little passage leading to it. So you can get in and put libations with your dead ancestor or bury another ancestor with them. And this passage tomb technique is one that develops in Brittany. So it's the distribution of these tombs, the West Side story, which we're talking about, the distribution of these tombs all up the Irish Sea that links into southern Brittany. And there are similar pots being found as well. The pots like those being made in southern Brittany are being found at certain points along the sea route. So that's one of the first contacts, probably going back to 4,300, 4,200, before the Neolithic really got into Britain from the east side.
And how confident can you be that that direction of cultural contact is going from Armorica through to the west of Britain and not the other way? Presumably you've got dating evidence to support that.
Yeah. So there are radiocarbon dates, reasonable radiocarbon dates, and they're earlier in Brittany than the earliest ones we've got in Britain so far.
Okay. Now, you've introduced us to my next question, which is one of the things that that many listeners might associate with Brittany if they've been on holiday there is its fantastic prehistoric megalithic remains, so stone remains. Particularly, I'm thinking Stone Rose. The most obvious one is Karnak on the south coast, this amazing stone alignment that goes on for an incredible distance, and burial chambers as well, which you talked about. Can you give us just a bit more of a taste of that and tell us if there's a tradition that goes across the two parts of land that we're talking about here?
Yeah. What you get in Brittany from in the Mesolithic period, before the Neolithic come in, you get some of these little stone-built tombs, stone kists, and Mesolithic hunters are being buried in them. So there is a tradition of burying people in stone kists. There's also a tradition of building long mounds, sometimes covering these kists. And another tradition that begins, possibly back in the Mesolithic period in Brittany, is the idea of standing stones in rows. The earliest ones, or the ones that look the earliest, are really very, very simple indeed, just local boulders that are just erected in a row. By the time you move on a bit, it gets more and more and more sophisticated until we get to, in the 5th millennium, wonderful structures like there is a famous site at Loch Mareaker, which is on the southern side of Brittany, there was a huge standing stone erected there called the Grand Menhir Brisé, it's called, because it's fallen down and broken, so it's Brisé. But when it was standing, this great stone, the stone itself would have been 21 metres long, and allowing for a bit in the ground, it must have stood something like 18 metres high. That's roughly a three-story house. No, it was a big stone. And the effort of putting that stone, bringing it from a quarry many kilometres away, putting it up, standing it there, and then carving it with horned, probably cattle, and a curious feature, a creature, which some people identify as a whale, and it may well be. But you put up this great stone and you carve it, and then you put 18 other stones behind it, all carved. Now, that is very sophisticated. It grows out of the Breton tradition, the Armorican tradition. It's not introduced from anywhere. Then from that, of course, you get slightly later these great stone rows that you find at Karnak, where there are rows and rows and rows of stones, sort of up to 10 rows of stones going for kilometres across the countryside. Amazing monuments. So that's one side of the megalithic tradition. The other side is the burial tradition, where it grows out of this idea of the kist, putting bodies in the kist, and then the idea of creating a passageway leading to it, so that you can add additional burials. And we call them passage graves. They develop quite widely in Europe. They're known in Spain, they're known in Brittany, they're known in Ireland and Britain and up into Orkney and Shetland and across into France. And someone has recently done a very, very detailed study of all the radiocarbon dates from these graves. And they reckon that they probably did originate in Brittany, in the Morbihan, in this southern part of Brittany, where they are at their best and where all these stone rows are. And the idea is that they originated there and they spread from there northwards along the Irish Sea into western Britain and south across to Galicia and down the coast of Iberia.
So I was about to fly us forward to the pre-Roman Iron Age, but we can't overlook the Bronze Age. So that's the period of metalwork. So very briefly, tell us what's the story in the Bronze Age.
Well, the story again is this West Side story. We've got people going backwards and forwards across the sea from Brittany, Wales, Ireland and Scotland and so on. The crucial bit here is that when copper metallurgy starts, it starts sometime in the early third millennium in Portugal. There are prospectors coming out from Portugal. They come to Brittany. And those prospectors move on along the seaways into Ireland, where we find about 2400 BC. And so develops in southern Ireland, South Wales, Cornwall and Devon and Armorica, a very special metal-using economy. It starts off as a copper-using economy, but it's there that bronze develops for the first time in Western Europe. And it develops there because it's in those areas in Brittany and southwest Britain that there is tin. And this is absolutely the driver for increasing contact and increasing continuity. The rarity of tin, the comparative rarity of gold, which you get from Cornwall and Southern Ireland, and also the comparative rarity of copper. And that little area is bound together by the sea. It's a metal-rich area, and it's an area of incredible innovation. And once that's underway, then develops what is called the Atlantic Bronze Age, which links that nucleus with the Spanish nucleus. And so you get this great continuity of ideas and metalwork and technology stretching from Spain right the way up to Shetland.
So you're describing there a very connected West Side metallurgical story. Is that at odds with something with the East Side story in Britain? Is something different going on there?
Well, yes, to the extent that it doesn't have metal. And it's the metal that is the driver for the intensity of the contact. You're getting contact across the North Sea as well. At the same time, in parallel with this, so people coming across the North Sea, Beaker people coming across the North Sea and so on. But contacts develop across the North Sea in parallel with this. But it's the metal is the real driver for the intensity along the Atlantic seaways.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
When the Doomsday was written at the end of the 11th century, one-fifth of the land of Britain was owned by Bretons.
Right, moving forward in time then to the pre-Roman Iron Age. So that's we've gone forward in time from the Bronze Age. Have we still got a very connected West Side society? How much interaction was going on? And I wonder, was Brittany in any way closer to Britain in terms of culture and society then than it was to France, to what was to become France to the east?
What really happens is with the Iron Age, as the name implies, a new metal sort of creeps in, and it's found just about everywhere, and it tends to knock the bottom out of the copper market and the tin market. So the what we see in the West is a sort of breakdown of this great Atlantic Bronze Age system, and much more regionalisation. And Britain and Brittany begin now to develop their own sort of regional cultures, really quite separate. They're not absolutely separate because there's plenty of evidence of contact between them. But Brittany very much looks in on itself, and it develops a wonderful Iron Age culture with these souterrains, which are underground storage units for corn and dried meat and things like that. It develops stelae, out of the tradition of the standing stone. The tradition continues, but in the Iron Age they are beautifully carved and sometimes decorated. And it develops its own very distinct pottery, decorated pottery. But there are links with Britain, but it's very much an isolated culture and very different from the rest of France. If anything, it is closer to southwest Britain than it is to its neighbouring part of France.
In Cornwall, you do get souterrains, don't you? The fogus that they would be called.
That's right. You get the same idea of putting your seed corn and probably your other valuables that you need to keep cold and at an even temperature, putting them under the ground. They're called fogus in Cornwall and souterrains in Brittany. And you do get decorated pottery of a slightly similar kind. And we know that there are links between them because there are bronze bowls which are being traded I think between Brittany, although none have been found in Brittany, but what you've got in Brittany are pottery copies of these bronze bowls. And you find the bronze bowls in Devon and in Ireland and so on. So there's evidence of contact still, but still maintaining this Western link, but now slightly more separate and going their own way and developing their own very distinct regional cultures.
And sorry to all our Cornish listeners for my mispronunciation of Fugu. My mother will be furious with me because I have Cornish ancestry. But anyway, there we are. Live and learn. What does the arrival of Rome do to the story? How does it change the situation in both Brittany and Britain? Because the Roman experience is different on either side of the Channel, I guess. Mm.
Yeah, there is, in fact, an early bow wave effect of Romanization. When the Romans move into southern France, into Provence, which they do 120 BC, that sort of period, they develop a wine trade and offload a lot of their cheap old Italian wine on the poor unsuspecting Celts living in southern France and make a big profit out of it. They really do make a profit out of it. They charge a denarius on every amphora of wine that goes from one town to another. It's a big profit. Anyway, this wine then sort of pervades the whole of the artery system of France and Armorica and across to Britain. And what we find is that Roman wine amphorae, this is between the period, say, about 120 BC to about 50 BC, these Roman wine amphorae pass from the Mediterranean across the river system into the sort of Bordeaux area, and then by ship up to Brittany, probably across the Breton Peninsula rather than around it, to ports like Saint-Malo, which was, there was an Iron Age site there. And then they are traded from there across the sea to Britain, particularly to Hengistbury Head, which is on the coast not far from Poole Harbour. And I excavated there and we found these Roman amphorae there. We also found figs. Or rather fig seeds, and glass. And so these are Mediterranean luxuries which are suddenly flowing into the trading system. And what we see in the period from about 100 to about 50 BC is this very tight link between Saint-Malo, or the Saint-Malo-Saint-Brieuc area, the north coast of Brittany, and Hengistbury Head and Poole Harbour, and boats going backwards and forwards for many, many years. And I think the model that probably fits best is of a sort of summer camp of Bretons at Hengistbury Head, that they load up their ships in Brittany with masses of amphorae and stuff a few figs in and bags of glass and stuff like that, and take it off to Hengistbury and then stay there for the trading season. And what comes out of Britain are hides, slaves, corn and metals. And so you can imagine people bringing those things from Britain to Hengistbury Head. And there are the Breton traders trading and swapping their amphorae of wine for slaves and so on, and then going back to Brittany. And this is before the Romans have got to Brittany. But so it's trade in advance of Romanization. And then, of course, in the 50s, 57, 56 BC, Caesar is active in this area. Caesar moves into Gaul and moves very quickly across Gaul. One of the first things he does is to try and buy off all the tribes in the northwest, the whole of the Armorican tribes and the tribes along the channel. He sort of does a deal and thinks that's it. And then settles down, and goes home, in fact, and just leaves his troops there. And the locals think, hey, this is not a good place to be, and let's kick these Romans out and object. So there is a Breton revolution against the presence of Caesar's troops. And the next year, I mean, it's very serious. Caesar comes back. He builds a fleet just off the mouth of the Loire. In fact, he gets some local ships, moves his army up and so on. And then when he's all poised, land troops, maritime troops, he moves in on Brittany with a vengeance destroys the Breton resistance and does the usual sort of thing of killing off all their headmen and taking the rest as slaves and so on. So that's how Brittany sort of meets the Romans in a sort of head-on collision. And that is, of course, 90 years before the Romans actually move into Britain. So Britain is still Iron Age and free from Rome when Brittany is taken over. And what Caesar does is to stop this trade immediately with Britain. He doesn't like the Armoricans liaising with Britain because they were getting reinforcements from Britain. So he seems to cut that trade, and the trade starts in a different direction, well, across the Channel, in fact. It continues across the English Channel between sort of Dover and Kent, that sort of, or Dover and Essex. It brings to an end this contact. And then gradually, it takes quite a long while for Brittany to settle down. It had a very rough time under Caesar. And there are one or two hints of rebellions going on for the next 20, 30, 40 years. But then it quietens down and Romanization sets in, and it gets the usual towns and road systems and so on.
So Brittany did eventually become part of Roman Gaul. It was a part of that province.
Yeah, from about the 20s BC, after the horror of Caesar's conquest had died down and people began gradually to see the benefits of Romanization, Brittany was as Romanized as the rest of Gaul, and as Romanized as Britain itself became when Claudius invaded in 43. And so you have this system of roads, you have big towns developing, have industries developing, and some of the Bretons, the elite Bretons, become Roman citizens and administrators and so on. It's a normal Roman package of Romanization.
And you go into some detail about the sort of the brutality of those Gallic Wars in the book. It's very interesting. I wonder, is there any evidence of Breton Armorican emigres going to Britain at that point when the Romans were being so brutal? Can we see that?
There are hints of this. There are hints of people getting out. One of the hints is on the island of Jersey, where there are a lot of coin hoards of Breton coins, Armorican coins, which suggests that people might be fleeing to the offshore islands. And we do find some of these coins appearing in Britain as well. But it's very difficult to see any major culture change in Britain at this time. It doesn't mean to say there weren't refugees pouring in. It's just that they weren't recognisable in the archaeological record.
Okay, so the place you mentioned there, the Channel Islands, so that's between Britain and Brittany in the yes. Across the stretch of water there. So what happens after the Roman interlude then? So both sides of the Channel both get Romanized, as you said, Britain somewhat after Brittany, but nevertheless both Romanized. Is this the point when we finally start to see a flow of people from Britain to Brittany? Because it does seem that throughout the broad span of prehistory we've talked about, quite a lot of the story has been sort of flowing north and west from Brittany.
Yeah, yeah. What happens is at the end of the Roman period, well, towards the end of the 3rd century, so we're still well within the Roman period, there are raids coming from north of the Roman frontier, and particularly raids by sea. And those raids spread into the Channel, and Brittany is part of this area that is dragged into putting up defences against raiders from the sea. But the other thing that happens in Brittany, which is extremely interesting and is referred to by a number of texts, is that the Britons begin to revolt. They're called Rusticani, you know, the country dwellers, the rustic people, those who are not part of the urban elite. So we've got countryside versus urban elite, I think. And the first rebellion we get is in the late 3rd century. And then into the 4th century, there are more rebellions. So you're getting a Breton resistance movement developing among the countryside dwellers. And as this goes on, the rest of the Roman Empire is beginning to crumble, and barbarians are moving in, the Franks are moving in, the Huns move in, the Alans move in, and so on. And towards the end, when we're getting into the 5th century, just the beginning of the 5th century, Romans are using the barbarians, using Huns, using Alans, to fight the Britons. To fight these rebelling rusticani, these rebels, the Gordi, they're called. So you've got a peasant revolt, basically, and then into that peasant revolt come the Britons. What is happening at this stage is that the Saxons are moving into the British Isles, and that is pushing some of the British further and further west. And Gildas, one of the near contemporary sources, talks about this in rather sort of glowing terms, rather over-egged. But essentially, he says that people are getting on their boats in Britain and sailing away to Brittany. He doesn't say to Brittany, but sailing away. And that's, in fact, what happens. Refugees from the west of Britain, probably from Dorset, Devon, Cornwall, that sort of area, possibly from South Wales, get on boats and sail to Brittany, because that's their traditional links are with the Bretons. They've probably got relations over there anyway. It's not a sudden invasion of foreigners. There are familial links. So they're getting out of the way of the Saxons and moving into this Armorican peninsula. And then we can recognise them, because they take with them a particular form of Celtic called Brittonic, which is rather different from the kind of Celtic that was being spoken in Armorica at that stage. And from place names like Plu and Loch and Tre and Ker, these place names suddenly start to appear, and they appear in northern and western Brittany. And from that stage onwards, we are now correct in calling it Brittany, because the Britons have moved in, and Brittany gets its name from the Britons who have moved in. And this is in the 5th and 6th century. It's probably a continuous movement, or a flow, an ebb and flow movement. But it looks as though, from the number of place names and the density of these place names, that it must have been quite a considerable population move. And it may well be that Brittany itself by this stage was fairly depopulated as the result of all the peasant rebellions that were going on.
So quite a big population transfer, possibly, and as you say, attested historically and in place name evidence. Is it attested archaeologically? Can you?
To some extent, yes. You can begin to see a new type of settlement in one of the sites I excavated in Brittany, a place called Liode, which is a Roman fortification near Lannion on the sea, on an estuary. We've got evidence of metalwork, which is quite similar to metalwork used in Britain, horse trappings and so on. And people move in and start farming the land and setting up their lazy beds. Sort of glorified sort of thing you find on modern allotments, you know, establishing their communities. They also, of course, the other thing that there is evidence for is the movement of religious leaders, the so-called saints who move in, but the religious leaders of the communities who often give their names to the locations. And these we can trace, and there are stories of the saints' lives, trace them coming from Wales and Ireland and through southwest Britain. So quite often you get a plu name, meaning the people, and then you get a saint's name linking the two. So there's a lot of evidence converges on that.
And you've got a really good bit in the book about those saints and what that tells us. You mentioned mm-hmm. Celts earlier. Perhaps we could just dwell on that phrase for a second, because it's a bit of a difficult phrase to grapple with. What does that mean, Celtic, Celts? And does it mean something, do you think, different to an archaeologist as it does to a historian?
It's becoming a very difficult phrase to use, a word to use now, because so much work is being done on this. Linguists, archaeologists, and ancient DNA is all beginning to contribute to a revolution in our understanding. But to talk simply about it, start with Caesar says that Gaul is divided, in that famous phrase, Gaul is divided into three parts. There are the Belgae in the north, there are the Aquitani in the southwest, and in the whole of the centre, which includes Armorica, of course, there are the Gauls, but they call themselves Celts. And Caesar actually says that they call themselves Celts. So by the time Caesar is there, the whole of the west, central part of France, including Armorica, is essentially Celtic, and that's the word they use for themselves. Go back a couple of hundred years, 300 years, when the Greek Pythias was sailing around Armorica and sailing around Britain. He talks about Armorica as Celtici, and that's sort of 320 BC. So certainly we can say, no doubt, by back to 300s, they were calling themselves Celts. Now, the old idea of Celts originating in Central Europe and moving west and fighting their way and drinking their way and raping their way into the West and into Britain, it's basically rubbish. What actually happened is much more difficult to say. Some of us, not everyone, but some of us think that the Celtic language really developed into its recognisable form as part of this Atlantic, Bronze Age Atlantic culture, when people were so in contact with each other, they're exchanging technological ideas, religious ideas, cosmological ideas, and that was when the Celtic language started. So we could say that the people in the Armorican Peninsula called themselves Celts long before the Romans got there, and they were speaking a language which we call Celtic.
Okay, so it's reasonable to speak of the Celts as a people in Brittany and indeed in Western Britain during this period, and to think that they would have called themselves by that name as well.
Yes, I think it is reasonable to think that they recognised some sort of ethnic overarching identity. They're of course individual tribes and fighting each other, but some ethnic identity, and they did speak the same language as well, or versions of the same language, which we call Celtic.
Okay, good. Well, that's helpful to clarify that, and it comes laden with different meanings now, and perhaps we'll come on to that at the end of this conversation. So, moving on again a bit, just charging forwards. We move into the Viking period or the Viking Age, when we see incursions from Scandinavia, raiders and traders across the seaboard of both Britain and Brittany. And this is from the 8th century onwards, I guess. Is it the same story on both sides? Does Brittany suffer the same sort of Viking attacks that Britain does?
Yeah, it's very much the same story, but with a little a nuance to it. The Bretons at this stage, as you say, we're talking about 8th, 9th, 10th centuries. The Bretons at this stage, their main enemy were the French, the Franks. And they were fighting the Franks more or less consistently throughout this period. When the Vikings move in, sometimes the Bretons fight the Vikings and the French. Sometimes the Vikings join up with the Bretons and they fight the French. So the Vikings are a third force that can be used by either the Franks or the Bretons. But essentially, a lot of Vikings move in. They like estuaries. And some Vikings move into the Seine estuary. We'll come back to them in a minute. Another lot move into the Loire estuary, which the main town, the Roman town of Nantes, was there. And so Nantes features large in this. And from the Loire estuary, they raid into Brittany. other lots are raiding from Frisia, and from the Seine estuary are raiding all around the coast of Brittany as well. So you've got this whole series of raid after raid after raid. what happens is a load of Vikings under a man called Rollo, who are trying to settle in the Seine Valley, are actually given land by the French and said, OK, look, the easiest way to stop more raids getting upriver to Paris is to give you the land downriver from Paris and you keep the rest of the Vikings off. So Rollo sort of settles there and he becomes... they become the Normans, essentially. That is Normandy, their descendants are the Normans. But from that area, more raiders start attacking Brittany. So you've got this constant flood of Viking raiders coming. And what happens is some of the Breton elite shows these close connections with Britain. They flee to Saxon Britain. And Æthelstan, King Æthelstan in Britain, gives them land and looks after them. So you've got these Breton refugees in Britain. And there's a famous one, Alan Twisted Beard, Barbatot, Alain Barbatot, who is an elite Breton in the court of Æthelstan. And he's constantly in touch with his spies, his Christian spies, who are in the monasteries. And they say, well, now is the time to come and free Brittany. And so he and some English troops land at Dol, which is not far from Saint-Malo, and then do this great sweep through Brittany, beating off the Vikings everywhere they go. And the slight difference between Britain and Brittany is the Vikings. In Britain, the Vikings are really land-grabbing towards the end and settling. In Brittany, it's not like that, except in the Loire estuary. They're much more raiders and sort of living off the land. So it's easy to round them up and beat them up. So in the 930s, Alain lands and moves. It's an interesting move. He lands in Dol, goes along the north coast, and then right through the centre of Brittany down to the south, beating off Saxons wherever he meets them. And then he homes in on Nantes, which is their centre, and kicks them out of Nantes, and then chases the remnant back up north and then destroys them. And this is the end of the Vikings. And it's all due to this local hero, really, with British support, English support, getting rid of them.
And so this was in Æthelstan's reign. This will be in the 10th century, early half 10th century.
Yeah, Alain moves back into Brittany in 936. And by 939, just 3 years, he's sort of got rid of the Vikings from Brittany. So by the middle of the 10th century, Brittany is free again.
And he was doing that with English support.
With some English support, yes.
Yeah. But yeah. I mean, Æthelstan was sort of famous for trying to build up the whole Kingdom of England. You know, famous for calling himself the King of the English. Did he have designs on Brittany?
No, I don't think so. I think not at this stage. I think it is really these familial relationships which go back generation after generation after generation, and they were just playing on those relationships, and they continue right the way through centuries on from the point where we are at the moment in the 10th century. The British were often coming across to help support the Bretons against the French.
And it sounds like by this point Brittany has got a clear regional identity versus the Frankish that you talked about, and I guess also the Anglo-Saxon in England.
Yes, very distinct identity. And it's been fighting from about 750s to about 830. So that's just before the Vikings. There are a whole series of campaigns from the Franks, the Carolingian Empire, into Brittany, trying to conquer Brittany and failing because the Bretons use guerrilla tactics. And there were seven of these campaigns. And it was during that time that really the Breton identity was forged. That the easiest way to forge an identity is to have an enemy. And the Franks, the Carolingians, were the enemy. So you could, you know, really create your sense of identity and your sense of unity by fighting them constantly. And all your aggressive instincts could be geared not against your neighbours, whose land you wanted, but against that lot outside, the outsiders. So it's very much a them and us. So that by the time the Vikings come, this forging of Breton identity was pretty well complete.
Now, you reminded us a second ago of the Viking origins of Normandy, and Normandy abuts Brittany. It's directly to the east of it. And, of course, the Normans famously invaded England in 1066. There were, I believe, quite a few Bretons in the Norman invasion fleet. So are we seeing a Breton influx back into Britain, into England, after the conquest in the second half of the 11th century?
Yeah, exactly that. The Norman invasion was an opportunity for angry young men to really make their fortunes. So that within what William did was to create a focus for would-be warriors from the whole of northern France to come together under his leadership. And some of them were Bretons. And in fact, when the Doomsday was written at the end of the 11th century, one-fifth of the land of Britain was owned by Bretons. And some of those were Bretons who went with the Normans. There were really three clusters of Bretons in Britain. There was the sort of old money cluster, as it were. These were the Bretons who had gone across before the Norman invasion, like the people who went and fled from the Vikings and were given land by the English kings. And they they really had land in East Anglia, in Norfolk and Suffolk. They were there already. And there were others, like Alain Leroux, who was a Breton who fought at the Battle of Hastings, and he was given land in Yorkshire, the Richmond estates in Yorkshire, and he had big estates. The Bretons already there in East Anglia were given additional land by the Normans. There was another cluster of Bretons down in the southwest, in Devon, Cornwall, South Wales, that sort of area. So we've got these three big clusters of Bretons. These are Breton lords, but they would have had their entourage with them. And once they were there, of course, the mothers, brothers, cousins and sisters all moved in. So you got a sort of an influx of people from Brittany into Britain and as joining the landholding aristocracy. And the fascinating thing is that the lot in East Anglia fell out with the king. And their land was apportioned to the others. And the other two groups, the ones in Yorkshire and the ones in the southwest, came from rival groups in Brittany. So they were at daggers drawn with each other. So when Britain went into a civil war, the Stephen and Matilda civil war, one group sided with Stephen, one group sided with Matilda. So these were two Breton royal families fighting out their battles in Britain, in a British political context.
And I should have said, just before the Norman Conquest, the Bayeux Tapestry shows the Normans invading Brittany and William the Conqueror leading a force into Brittany. So clearly there were daggers drawn there. At what point Normandy eventually becomes part of France after quite a long story, which we can't go into, and so does Brittany. At what point does Brittany become more French than it was then?
Right. Well, as you say, Brittany becomes is part of the Angevin Empire, the empire that is essentially ruled by Henry II, which is the whole of Western France and the whole of the British Isles, really, and Brittany is part of that. In many ways, that British-held territory keeps Brittany separate from France. And the Breton identity continues to develop. And throughout the Middle Ages, you get wars of succession and civil wars in Brittany and so on. There is still this antagonism to France. And it goes on and on and on. And you gradually find they're developing a sort of pro-French party and an anti-French party in Brittany. And the whole thing really comes to a conclusion in with the death of Duke François in Brittany. Duke François dies in 1488. And he has his successor is his 11-year-old daughter, Anne, Duchess of Brittany. Only 11. And that the French see as the wonderful opportunity, the uncertainty of an 11-year-old taking over, a wonderful opportunity to move in and invade Brittany. And they do. And the British send an army, 6,000 troops, to support the Bretons against the French. But the pro-French party in Brittany decide that Anne is to be the centre person. And they are quite powerful, and they eventually marry Anne to Charles, King of France. And when Charles, King of France, dies, she's married to the next King of France, Louis. So it's a smart political move. You marry your Breton duchess to the King of France, and that virtually puts a stop for a while to the antagonism between them. And then in the great edict, which was passed in 1532, Brittany becomes part of France. Anne's dead by now. Brittany is part of France. And it's quite a good deal for the Bretons because what the French do is to promise a degree of autonomy for Brittany. They've got their own General Assembly, they've got their own parliament, they can appoint their own bishops. They cannot be called up to fight in foreign wars outside Brittany. They can only be taxed if their own parliament or General Assembly agree to the taxation. So the deal is a very, very good one. And it does bring to an end this period of continuous strife throughout the medieval period. And from then on, Brittany begins to flourish economically. It really takes off. But of course, the story, the French make one set of promises in 1532, and in the successive years, they break them one after another, and that causes more Breton discontent.
Okay, so we got to 1532. There's clearly another 500 years of all sorts of interesting things are going on, but I think that will be a podcast part deux, which we can't do. There's just a couple more points I just wanted to chat to you about before we finish, if you've got time. One is taking us back into the medieval period and tackling Arthuriana, because it's very interesting. If you go travel around Brittany, you see a lot of evidence of Arthurian stories. I've done it myself, and particularly a place like the Pampong Forest near Rennes. It's an amazing, lovely forest, and it's kind of got an Arthurian centre in it, in the middle of it, with all sorts of sort of mystical stuff going on there. What's going on? Why is Brittany part of the Arthurian mythology?
Yeah, it's a very, very interesting question, this. I mean, to try and sort of tease out the crucial bits, the Arthurian story as we know it really given to us. The main story is given to us by Geoffrey of Monmouth, who writes The History of the Kings of England, published about 1135. He lived not far from here, just down the road at Osney, just outside Oxford. And he wrote this History of the Kings of England. What he didn't know, he made up, basically. And within it is the germ of the Arthurian legend. Arthur is a British nobleman. When the Saxons come, he fights against the Saxons. He's successful. He decides to conquer Europe. While he's away, there's rebellion in Britain. He returns, gets a battle in injury and goes off to Avalon, where he may or may not die. You know, it's so that's the germ of the story told by Geoffrey. Now, there is also a parallel tradition in Brittany, which has Arthur and a lot of things that we don't find in Geoffrey's story. Excalibur, for example, comes from the Breton legend. The Round Table comes from the Breton legends, and so do some of the characters. So how do these relate? Well, I suppose the simplest explanation may not be the right one, but the simplest explanation is that when the British moved and went to settle in Brittany in the 5th and 6th century, this was the time when notionally Arthur was fighting the Saxons in Britain, they took with them stories of their hero into Brittany, so that the Arthurian legend got into Brittany as the result of the British, and there became embroidered with local stories of local heroes who coalesced with the story of Arthur. So that's one possibility. That and in that way, they got into the troubadour tradition, the French troubadour tradition, the jongleurs who sang songs, the conteurs who told stories in the courts. And these were stories about great Arthur and all the people associated with him. And they sort of pervaded Western European society and then got back into Britain. So that would be the simplest interpretation. I mean, there are others that might see Arthur as one of these late Roman soldiers who went across and fought in Brittany and came back to Britain. Some people have suggested that. But I think it is one tradition that certainly becomes much, much, much richer as a result of what the Bretons have got to add to it than what the British gave it.
Thank you. I mean, it's a very complicated business, this Arthurian story. And the listeners might be, I should remind you that we've got a podcast in our archive, an interview of Professor Ronald Hutton talking about that a little while ago. And I should mention that Ronald Hutton, who's an eminent historian, he's quoted on the back of your book. He says that you are one of the greatest, one of our greatest living archaeologists. So that's a nice phrase. Now, look, just last thing, taking us back to the Celtic story again, a Celtic coda to finish, if we can. So yep. Brittany today would be seen by many people as part of kind of the pan-Celtic world, which would be Brittany, Cornwall, Wales, Ireland, Scotland, I guess. And there's all sorts of cultural events that sort of happen across that sphere. What does that mean? How is that part of this tradition? And is it completely separate idea of Celticness to what might have been an original idea of Celticness?
I think the Bretons always felt close to Britain. I mean, for all the reasons we've talked about. Very, very close contacts all the time. And they were always the other, and they were fighting the French. So their identity became very, very important, their Celtic roots. And this first comes out by in a book written by a man called Paul-Yves Pezeron, who was a Breton priest, and he published a book in 1703 called about the Celts and their language and so on. And he argued that the Celts started somewhere in the east of Europe, and they moved gradually west, and then they were wiped out in some parts, and the true Celts survived in Brittany. That's what he was arguing. And then these ideas were taken up by the great English scholar Edward Fluid, who wrote Archaeologica Britannica in 1706. And it was he who said, look, all these languages, Breton and Irish and Gaelic and Welsh and Cornish, are all one same language group, and I'm going to call it Celtic. And he liked what Pezeron was saying. And it was he who really formed this idea of a Celtic West, that in the West, the language and the culture of these Celtic people survived against Romans and Germans and Saxons and everyone else coming in. He would say that because he was a Welshman himself, and he was being anti-English at this stage. So There is the germ of the story. Now, it gets muddled because Napoleon likes Celts very much, and he likes to see Celts as the ancestor of the ancestors of the Gauls. And the Bretons say, well, yeah, OK, but you lot of Gauls are all overlaid by Franks and goodness knows what people coming in from across the frontiers. We're the true Celts. And when Napoleon begins to be very harsh, and his successors very harsh, to try and integrate Brittany totally into France, so the idea of Celtic Bretonness begins to develop. So it's got real roots in reality and in scholarship. And I think that perhaps the key point is a Breton nobleman called Elfsat de la Villemarquet, who in 1867 decided to set up a great inter-Celtic conference in Saint-Brieuc, which is on the north coast of Brittany. And he invited his brothers and his cousins and his compatriots from the other Celtic countries in Wales and Cornwall and in Ireland to this great Celtic conference. And it was a political move and an intellectual move as well, really, to cement the Celticness of the West, to give Brittany its exceptional nature in contrast to France. And then that goes on and develops and develops and develops.
That was Professor Sir Barry Cunliffe. His book, Bretons and Britons, The Fight for Identity, is out now, published by OUP. You can find a link in the show notes. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. Join us on Friday when Franny Moyle will be speaking about the Tudor court painter Hans Holbein.